This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the very best bits of today's show. It's a Tuesday, the 19th of April, lovingly created by our producer, Isa Havilio. What have we got for you today? Well, we're going to kick off with some of our top stories, including the World Bank cutting its growth forecasts, and we're going to hear from the boss of the IMF, Kristalina Georgieva. Talking about the booming UAE economy, Knight Frank, the real estate guys, Andrew Love, their head of office leasing, joins us in the studio to talk about booming office markets in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, but only for the grade A, really posh offices. We have crossed live to China to talk to Changcheng Zhu of the Economist Intelligence Unit. What are lockdowns in places like Shanghai and Shenzhen doing for the Chinese economy and indeed the global economy? And finally, talking energy with Robin Mills of Camar Energy as gas prices in the United States, natural gas prices that is, reach a 15-year high. All of that to come on the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Let us dive into some of the other big talkers today. And a little bit of a, maybe pessimistic is probably a little bit too harsh a word to use, but a couple of the forecasts, Rich, the financial forecasts, World Bank and their near neighbour, the IMF, not exactly what you want to be waking up to in the brand new week.
No, but it is reality biting. So big week in Washington. The World Bank and the IMF both based their sister organisation. It is their spring meetings. So you're going to get lots of reports, lots of commentary, and hopefully quite a few solutions as well. The World Bank kicked it off yesterday. We've heard from their president, David Malpass, and he has cut the forecast, or the World Bank has cut their forecast for global growth. One of our headline stories this morning by about one percentage point. And he's pledged $170 billion to try and help to fix the problem. So that's the World Bank. The IMF, from their side, have been speaking. Kristalina Georgieva is the managing director. And she gave what she called a curtain raiser interview ahead of the meetings to look at some of the big issues. And of course, they speak with one voice, the World Bank and the IMF. I mean, they're different, but they're the same. So she agrees that the war in Ukraine is the major economic issue facing the world at the moment. Yes, lockdowns in China, we just heard about those, they're an issue. But front and center, it's the war in Ukraine. And she says, let's hear from him now, that there are not one, not two, but three ways that it's rippling through the global economy.
The Russian invasion of Ukraine triggered spillovers through three main channels. The first one is commodity prices, wheat, oil, gas, metals. The second one is pressure that is put on inflation and the necessity for central banks to tighten up faster than they would have done otherwise, with all the consequences for emerging markets. And the third one are the financial channels, remittances, but also the impact on how the monetary system is going to look like after the war.
So three major economic implications, but she said by far the most important is commodity prices, and even more specifically, food prices.
From a human standpoint, the most dramatic one is indeed food prices. Why? Because that comes on top of already deepening food insecurity in many parts of the world. Remember, we had bad harvests in a number of countries, locusts in Africa, in the Horn of Africa. That all has already generated pressures. And now the war is hitting on the poor families of the world even more. So what can we do? There are two things we can do to help. The first one is provide preferably grants, provide financial support to countries so they can procure food for their people. And two, avoid trade restrictions. If we do not allow food to flow from one place to another, the global food situation would get worse.
Kristalina Georgieva, the Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund. We're going to hear more from these people throughout the coming days, and well, certainly throughout the coming days, but everyone will be looking for solutions. So the World Bank, just to recap, committing $170 billion to try and address these issues. That's going to be dispersed over the next 15 months, but, says David Malpass, the first $50 billion is going to come in the next 90 days or so. One of the questions is, what does it mean for us here in the UAE? Because While we're aware of the economic stresses around the world, particularly our near neighbours and dear friends in Sri Lanka, the reality is the economy here in Dubai feels like it's booming. It feels like it's doing very, very well. Partly, of course, high energy costs do benefit an energy exporter like the UAE. But we wanted to get some perspective from Shadi Shah Al-Borno, who's with Emirates NBD, where he's Senior Director of Group Research. We asked him for his analysis.
Strong growth for the UAE this year will be driven largely by what we're seeing in terms of growth dynamics in the oil sector. We're added production levels, in addition to higher oil prices, are supportive of the hydrocarbon sector. In terms of the non-oil sector, there have been some green shoots at the beginning of the year, particularly with the impact of Expo 2020 on overall tourism and growth metrics in Dubai, while other dynamics such as trade continue to perform quite well.
Shadi Al-Borno of Emirates NBD, and it does tie in with another of our interviews today, Tom, doesn't it? The guys from Knight Frank were in a little bit earlier on. We'll hear from Andrew Love later on. He heads up their, I forget his precise job title, but their office leasing business. And rents in both Dubai and Abu Dhabi for prime office space and demand back to almost pre-COVID-19 levels. Partly it's local companies expanding, partly it's new companies coming in, partly it's people upgrading from grade B to grade A office space. There is momentum in the economy here at the moment.
And one industry that is benefiting from that at present is the tailoring industry here. We know that the apparel industry worldwide has taken a little bit of a hit, but tailors have been part and parcel of the business infrastructure of Dubai, of the UAE for many, many years, and continue to be so down in hotspots like DIFC and elsewhere. We spoke to Prakash Palmer of House of Palmer a little earlier on, which are long-time residents of the UAE since the late 1950s. He was talking about just how busy it is at the moment. I think his words were, we can't keep up with the demand at present. They are looking to expand throughout this year. He was talking about the competition coming into the market as well. So it looks like with that return to the office, it's a return to some of the old formalities that went hand in hand with it.
But I tell you what's interesting. Both office, yes, is the office space is returning, the suits returning, but they're different.
Yeah.
Prakash was saying people are buying unstructured suits, not structured suits.
Yeah.
Offices are becoming much more informal, much more WeWork type spaces. So the same but different.
The same but different. Let's bring Serena into our conversation now. Serena Kelly is here with all things visa. In fact, just before we talk to Serena about the visas, it's also a question you put to Shadi, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So Serena's going to give us chapter and verse on the visas in a second. But first of all, we asked Shadi, from a macroeconomic or competitiveness perspective, why is the UAE doing this?
Human capital is certainly a key driver behind the latest announcements on visa entry and residency requirements. It's about creating competitive and flexible job market that's able to attract the talent that different sectors in the UAE need in order to power the economic agenda of the country ahead.
Those are Shadi's thoughts. Serena's in studio with us. So who are these visas going to attract?
Okay. Well, I've managed to comb through all the information and I have simplified it.
Oh, yeah.
And I have the main changes following yesterday's UAE cabinet meeting and the announcements regarding the residency visa system and entry visa system. So the main points: the age limit for sponsoring children has been raised. So it was 18, it is now 25. Obviously, we are already aware that there's no age limit for unmarried daughters, and children of determination are granted a residence permit regardless of their age. Tourists, those that are eligible for visa on arrival to the UAE, they can stay in the country for up to 60 days. It was previously 30, it is increased to 60. You have the regular tourist visa. You have the five-year multi-entry tourist visa. Some finer details regarding that five-year multi-entry visa, certain requirements that need to be met if you were interested in that visa, you need to have a bank balance of $4,000 for a period of, I think it's up to 3 or 6 months prior to you submitting your application. When it comes to golden residence visas, this is the long-term 10-year one. Main points. The age limit increase for sponsoring children also applies here. You can also sponsor domestic help. There is no limit to how many that you can sponsor. And if you are outside of the UAE, your visa will remain valid. There's no actual time frame or limit on this. It's going to stay valid if you are outside the country for more than 6 months, yeah, whichever. There is no restrictions. Also, should the golden visa holder pass away, the family's visa status who are also on the golden visa will not be affected. It will remain valid until its date of expiry. But that, those main points, that is pretty much the big announcements that have come out from yesterday. And obviously, you do have specifications with regards to the visas. When it comes to the green visas, that is, there's three of them. You've got the green residency visas for freelancers or self-employed, skilled or investors or partners. These are valid for 5 years. You do not need a host or a sponsor. And you can also sponsor first degree relatives as well in that regard. But if you need more details, it is up on the Air and News Centre app and website.
Great. And I'm sure we will be getting a lot more questions on this throughout the course of today. Mustafa's been in touch with us this morning. Mustafa Butwa asking, what about sponsoring parents? Is there any mention of sponsoring of parents on
So obviously, when it comes to the golden residency visa, that hasn't been specified or outlined. They mentioned spouse, they mentioned children, they mentioned domestic help. But obviously sponsoring your parents, for example, you know, a regular residency visa holder, that's still something that you can apply for. But I believe in certain cases that may only be valid for a year. But people, that's still something that is you're eligible to do. Just need to be specific if it is regarding the golden residency visa for that question.
Thank you very much indeed for that.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's get some more detail on one of our top stories this morning. Office rents in both Dubai and Abu Dhabi have begun to recover to pre-COVID levels. So say the real estate broker and consultancy Knight Frank, joining us in the studio now, is their partner and head of commercial agency for this region, Andrew Love. Morning, Andrew.
Morning, guys.
So rents bouncing back in the office market.
Indeed. Possibly, I'd probably say actually rising ahead of what they were pre-COVID.
Why?
A combination. Lack of supply. No developers have really been building new office buildings. I think a combination of new companies relocating here from Asia. And also just business sentiment. I think existing companies looking to expand as well. And probably a slight flight to quality, companies moving from older buildings to newer buildings.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I'm going to let you answer a question that Tom asked me earlier on, just before we move on. Some definitions. You guys in the commercial office market talk about things like grade A, grade B, grade C. How do you define grade A and how would you define this office that we're in now in Media City?
So grade A, you would typically have a number of lifts, usually one lift sort of per 12 persons. So if you go into the older sort of grade B, grade C buildings, where there's an undersupply of lifts, you will see generally queues. Now, I'm not going to call out specific buildings, but there is a number of those even in this area in Internet City where people are waiting over 20 to 30 seconds in the mornings. You shouldn't have that in a grade A building. You would then typically have raised floor boxes, suspended ceilings, and a floor-to-ceiling height of usually minimum 2.8 metres. Now, for us today, we'd probably see a grade A building will also have some sort of ESG credential.
ESG being?
Environmental sustainability and governance. So now looking at more sustainable work practice, whether that is solar or water recycling within the building, or even, you know, spaces to park your electric scooters.
So if this is the kind of office space that people want, and companies like yours, Knight Frank, or the big multinationals, companies moving in from Asia, you say, why aren't people building it?
I think if you look at where the demand is right now, it's been very much high-end luxury villa and residential sentiment. And I think the developers here have been largely focusing on that. And I think also, well, we know that historically there was a large oversupply of offices. So when it comes to development, you always have that lag and that period between where the market needs to catch up.
So what's going to happen? Okay, the grade A stuff down in DIFC or down in the downtown area, a lot of it in, some of it in Media City and Internet City is grade A. It's a lot of grade A stuff. But what's going to happen to the grade B and the grade C stuff? The stuff on, Tom and I were joking earlier on, the kind of Crown Plaza side of Shakeside Road or down in Bir Dubai and down in Deira. What happens to that? Does it get upgraded and repurposed or does something more radical have to happen?
A bit of both. Look, using your Crown Plaza is a great example. They've evicted half that side of the tower and they're going to refurbish it. So they have to reposition it. If they don't reposition it, then their rents will considerably drop until the point where either they have to, you know, they do the refurbishment or they knock it down and repurpose it. So we've seen it, you know, as I said, Crown Plaza being one example that they're looking to change the facade, strip it back to shell and core. If you look over the road in what was I still call TCOM C, which is Barsha Heights now, there's a tower there called Thuraya. They've just refurbished all the lobby area, started to upgrade the common areas because what we were seeing was a drastic drop in rents and occupancy levels.
But you can't really retrofit elevators, can you? That's a different level.
Well, look, if we use this area, Internet City, another Thuraya tower, a bit confusing, which is owned by EMBD, they have just replaced the lifts. They've put in new Coney lifts. So it can be done. It is expensive. It takes time. But where there is a shortage of lifts, yes, it's difficult to do.
What's happening in other Emirates like Abu Dhabi to the south or Sharjah to the north?
So Sharjah, less demand. We've seen a little bit of growth there. Abu Dhabi has been a very strong year. Again, similar story to here, no new office supply, but continuing of take-up.
So are people wanting to be on the island? Because I know, you know, when I started off here 20-odd years ago, the majority of meetings, business meetings you'd have in Abu Dhabi would be on the main island, down on, you know, down towards the Corniche, really. Is that still the area, or is it areas of new Abu Dhabi around the, is it the Smarty we're calling the Aldar building? Is it the Smarty
coin,
or the Frisbee? The coin?
Aldar have now moved from that building. They've moved into the mall. So there has been a move off island. There has been a shift. But, you know, ultimately, ADGM is still there, Almarai. So you still have there is demand from occupiers to be that side of town. But then there's also been new developments like Masdar, which is, you know, environmental, sustainable again.
What's happening inside of the building? People are going back to the office, it would seem. We weren't sure 2 years ago if they would, but offices are changing on this whole hybrid notion.
Yeah, I think, look, I'm pro-office. I share Mahmoud's, I think, text message, rest in peace working from home. You know, I do think it depends on what position
you're in. Well,
of course
you flog office space. Of course you think that.
No, Luke, I think it depends on what sector you work in. If you're in a sales role, you can perhaps work towards this hybrid, but if you're in other professions, then you can't. I think we've probably seen where there has been a downsizing in office. What we've seen is they've moved to better quality offices and more efficient space. So you might have a workforce saying, well, I'm occupying 20,000 square foot, and they move to 16,000, but they're moving to a better quality building and getting more space for that.
So, bottom line, how many hours a week are your staff doing the office on average, would you say, at night, Frank?
Well, if you're in the residential brokerage game, they're almost 24 hours just now.
but not in the office, in the four walls of the office.
I would say we're in the better part of eight to 9 hours, you know, full days now. You know, we're expanding. We ourselves are very close to relocating. We're going from 7,000 to almost 9,500 square foot.
Good talking to you, Andrew. Appreciate your time this morning. Andrew Love is partner, head of commercial agency Knight Frank Middle East.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's talk about the Chinese economy. Let's talk about lockdowns and the implications for us here in the UAE. Chan Chin Zhu is an economist at the Economist Intelligence Unit. He's based in Beijing in China and he joins us live. Tian Chen, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, good morning.
So we're reading so much about the lockdowns that are happening in different places around China at the moment. Where is it where you are? Explain where you are and then tell us what's happening in major centres like Shanghai, like Shenzhen, that have such a big impact on the global economy.
I'm personally based in Beijing, so the situation is pretty fine, but we are still seeing a lot of cases in Shanghai, still close to about 20,000 per day. However, I think regarding Shanghai's lockdown, the worst seems to be over now, as the majority of local residents don't have to scramble for food the way they did over the past few weeks. And the government is starting to mulling over a phased reopening, which prioritize the resumption of manufacturers. However, a full reopening of Shanghai and the nearby regions may still take take some weeks, possibly in mid-May. Yeah, so I think the economic shocks to China arising from the current round of the lockdown was still pretty big. According to our estimate at the EIU, the current lockdown in Shanghai and its spillover to nearby regions will cost 0.4% of China's GDP growth this year, and due to the loss in consumption as well as the current severe disruption to logistics.
If I can ask you about the GDP numbers that came out yesterday, and they were better than expected. First quarter GDP out of China, 4.8% growth. That's not spectacular, but it's more than economists were hoping for. What's your projection for the rest of 2022 and beyond?
Yeah. We do see there's improvement, or let's say an acceleration of GDP growth, because the last quarter, I mean, in the fourth quarter of 2021, it was 4%. So 4.8% is still higher than the previous reading. However, the 4.8% is still short of the government expectations of 5.5%, which means the government has a lot to do for the remainder of this year. And meanwhile, we're now seeing that the current Shanghai lockdown, the whole disruption to the industrial sector is adding fresh pressure to the economy. Yeah, so we're now expecting that China will eventually miss its growth target, but may well achieve some growth at about a little bit more than 5%. That's our expectations for 2022. Yeah.
Finally, Chan Chen, here in the UAE, here in Dubai, of course we look at this selfishly, partly from a global trade perspective. We are a global trade hub. But in terms of tourism and Chinese tourists, we miss Chinese tourists coming here to Dubai. We had almost a million or so in 2019. It was one of the fastest growing markets for Dubai in 2019. What's your best estimate of when Chinese tourists will return to Dubai? End of 2022, 2023, or even further out than that?
I don't think we can be really optimistic on this prospect, because in the wake of the current waves of the Omicron infections, I think the Chinese authorities are responding by, let's say, a more hardline approach to COVID-19 mitigation. For example, in some cities, whenever there are the emergence of some individual cases, let's say one case or two cases, the government will immediately like lock down the whole district or the whole city. So they are taking a very hardline approach to that, and that will continue until the Communist Party Congress in the autumn of this year. If the Omicron outbreaks continues, I think they may well close the border. They may well close the border for like two-way population flow, tourist flow, until, let's say, the late 2023. So it will be late.
Chan Chen, appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much indeed. Chan Chen Zhu is an economist at the Economist Intelligence Unit based in Beijing in China.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Joined by friend of the Business Breakfast, Robin Mills, is the CEO of Camar Energy, joins us live on Microsoft Teams. Morning, Robin.
Hi, morning, everybody.
Can we start with those natural gas prices? Looking at the story on CNN this morning, natural gas futures surged to levels unseen since 2008 as the northeast braces for a rare April blast of heavy snow. The looming nor'easter will force millions of families to crank up the heat in the coming days. Is this just a short-term blip or something bigger?
Yeah, a bit of both, really, Richard. Yeah, I see all my American friends saying how the snow has come. So, you know, it is a little bit to do with weather. And, you know, you'd think this late in the year, this will just be a cold spell and they'll soon be out of it. And then temperatures will start going up and gas prices will start coming down. But it's also a bit of a change in the U.S. natural gas market. You know, you mentioned this is the highest price since 2008. I think Americans had got used to natural gas prices being remarkable lows all that period and kind of forgotten that natural gas prices could ever go up. But now they are. And this is really, I think, two things going on. One is record U.S. exports of natural gas. So the U.S. has really been cranking up its liquefied natural gas exports to other countries. And, of course, Europe very much wants that right now. And the other thing is just that U.S. production has not recovered to pre-pandemic levels. Drillers are not drilling as much as they used to.
What about the situation in Europe? Because gas is not like oil, is it? Oil tends to, and gold, they tend to have one price globally. They fluctuate a bit, but it's kind of one price globally. Gas is very much a localized market, or to a large extent, a localized market. What are gas prices doing in Europe, as you mentioned, such an important market at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, gas prices in Europe, of course, are far higher, right? So, you know, the $7 in the US, Europeans would have thought that was like an average price of the past few years. They're now at $30 or $35. Equivalent, so you know they're five times as high, and that's exceptional, and that shows a real crunch on European energy supplies. But natural gas in Europe is far more expensive.
So where do we stand on Europe, and in particular Germany's efforts to wean itself off Russian natural gas? I mean, we know, but it bears repeating, 55% or so of Germany's natural gas comes from Russia at the moment. Over the next two or three years, it wants to wean itself off that, but it's not a overnight process. Where do we stand with that, Robin?
Well, you know, German politicians have been flying across the world looking for new supplies, and the US has promised to send more. But that's gas that probably would have come to Europe anyway. The German minister has been in the Gulf as well, looking for supplies from here. But there really is very little spare capacity. So Germany and Europe in general has already sucked up a lot of the spare gas that was going globally. And Germany's dependence on Russian gas has fallen a bit in the past few months. But there's also a bit of a conundrum because Europe needs to refill its storage, which is really depleted. So in the kind of short term, Europe actually needs to bring in more gas to fill that storage before next winter. So that's all contributing to this squeeze on supplies. Europe is in a tough position for now.
And of course, building an LNG receiving facility is not a small operation, is it? And Germany, which is not quite landlocked, but you know doesn't have an awful lot of sea facing coastline, faces challenges in that regard, doesn't it?
It does. And Germany has no LNG import terminal, so it has to bring in gas from neighbouring countries. And it wants to build two to three, maybe even four of these terminals now. Those will be up and running by 2025, 26, you know, at best. So, yes, this is kind of a medium-term solution, not a short-term one. And even once you build a terminal, then you need supply. You need another country that's built an export facility.
Let's talk about the oil price right now, around about $113 a barrel for Brent crude. Part of it is the situation in this region. It's Libya. The National Oil Corporation has shut down one of its fields, the El Feel oil field. Explain briefly the situation there and the impact it's having on the oil market, Robin, please.
Yeah, so absolutely, this is pushing up prices. El Feel is a very important field deep in the Libyan desert, and there are protests against the prime minister in the west of Libya, and these protests have shut down the terminal that El Feel exports through. So this is shutting off a large part of Libyan supply right now. Libyan oil production has been very volatile, of course, ever since its revolution in 2011. And I think we expect that to continue. These protests probably will end in a few days, but you know, then there'll be some other issue that affects Libyan supplies. And Libya is an important supplier of its very light sweet crude into southern Europe.
Very quickly, a couple of other stories to talk to you about. On a more positive note, Abu Dhabi has secured a $100 million contract. It's going to build a wind farm in Taiwan.
Yeah, I saw the very interesting story, and actually was down at another Abu Dhabi-based or UAE-based company, actually Petrofac, and which was working with Dubai dry docks to build a wind farm facility for the Netherlands a few weeks back. So interesting to see UAE-based companies getting active in offshore wind. Offshore wind in Europe has been doing tremendously well, a new green source of energy, and great to see this in Taiwan as well.
With love, Robin, do we really have expertise in building wind farms? I get that we have expertise in solar plants because we've got an awful lot of sun. But in terms of wind farms, is it not the Danes and people like that who lead the charge?
I mean, they have a lot of expertise, but of course, a lot of this is about offshore engineering, right? And the UAE has expertise in that too because of the offshore oil industry. So a lot of this is quite similar, putting big platforms out in the sea, platforms that will be there for 30, 40 years, have to stand up to a lot of weather and waves. So that is a very transferable expertise.
Finally, I know you've been looking at this story. We've talked about it as well. Krispy Kreme pegging the price of its donuts to a gallon of gasoline or petrol in the United States.
Yeah, pretty fun story, this one, setting the price of their dozen of donuts at the average price of gasoline, which I think was at the moment was $4.11, which is kind of less than half of their regular price for the donuts. So that's a bit of a gimmick, I suppose, trying to give people a benefit when they're feeling the squeeze at the pump.
Well, they'd be feeling a squeeze in their jeans if they're eating donuts all the time.
Yeah, well, at that price, that's a bargain, right? Less than half the price.
Finally, I was going to say that was my final question. Manuel has written in with a question. Only 30 seconds on this one. Given the situation in Europe, what about a return to nuclear energy in Europe, particularly in Germany, which turned its back on nuclear a decade ago?
Well, look, I think there absolutely should be a rethink on nuclear power and using more of it. But I think German politics is pretty much set, and the Germans had a chance to keep their nuclear plants running in the middle of this crisis and basically said they're not going to. So I think the politics is against it, unfortunately.
Robin, always great to talk to you. Appreciate your time this morning. That is the voice of Robin Mills. He's the chief executive of Camar Energy.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.